They're all out on their feet, but Man of Class responds now. He gets two lengths in front of Darfur. Benestrand is still coming on the outside. Man of Class out on his feet. Here comes Benestrand. Darfur's coming back on the inside. A big finish in the Grand Daniel. Benestrand on the outside. From villain to hero. He's won it in a photo from Man of Class and Darfur.
Well, that was a moment in history down at Warrnambool. That was 2013 Benestrand, and it was memorable for so many reasons, because a year or two earlier he jumped into the crowd and had me dispatched to the Warrnambool Hospital to look after the injured. But the jockey was Gavin Bedgood, and that was Benestrand in the Grand Annual. And the Grand Annual was just a mere chapter of Gavin Bedgood's life that has now culminated in being one of the informed trainers in Victoria. And he's been kind enough to get his way through peak hour traffic to join us. Hey, Bedgie.
How are you, Matty?
I did get that text in Latrobe Street, and I thought, this is going to be tricky. But I think you might have parked in a tow-away zone just to get here in time.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'll have to find my car when I get out of here, but worry about that later.
Thanks for coming in. It's hard for you guys like you, isn't it? I mean, it's such a busy... every day is... time's precious, and you're very hands-on. So you must have got a bit done early this morning.
Yeah, we worked 22 by 7 o'clock, and... got home, made the feeds, and went home, had a shower, and on my way.
You're not on track, are you, at Cranbourne?
No, we're about 10 minutes off course on a 20-acre property.
When you say we, it is a small operation, isn't it? You do a lot of the stuff yourself, and so does Karen, your partner?
Yep, me and my partner Karen, we work together, and we've got a team of about half a dozen that work with us. Track work riders, truck driver, a few girls that work back at the stables, and then some ground staff at the track.
What time does your alarm go off?
2:30.
How many snooze whacks before you actually get up?
Yeah, there's normally one.
That's ridiculous.
It's what you got to do. I've done it for a long time now, so I don't really know any different, I suppose.
Are you? Do you get by with not much sleep? Because I've been out to dinner with you a few times, and you're still kicking goals at sort of 9:30. Are you? Have you learned to live on sleep deprivation?
Yeah, normally if I sleep during the day, I don't sleep that well of an evening. So, normally somewhere between 8:30 and 9:30 at night, I try and get to bed, and that enables me to get up early in the morning.
How many trips to the track? I imagine there's only one truck and more horses than can fit into one truck.
Yeah, 3 truck loads and a float load of a morning, and that gets them all there and home. And, yeah, it normally takes us, we have the first load at the track by 3:30, and we're on the first lot by 4 o'clock, and we're out of there by about 8:30.
Do you like to be the first one, make first use of the track?
Yep, for sure. When I worked for Robbie Lang, he was big on that. You first one out, you get the best surfaces to work on, and get first use of the grass, first use of the sand. And especially when you've got older horses that aren't that sound, that might have a few maintenance issues, it's always good to try and get the optimum surface for them.
It seems like you and... I know Reece Goodwin's doing a good job as well, and there's a bit of a link with the Inglis Online horses as well, but that's the one percenters. Are you finding that in a really competitive environment, it is those little things, isn't it? And getting first use of the track, and it's not a one percenter, it's about a 30%er, is that you ride your own work. I'm trying to work out this amazing strike rate of yours. Your last 50 runners, 22%. You've trained 59 winners in next to no time. It was a blink of an eye ago that you and I were standing under the corrugated iron at Woolamai, and you had picnic horses. So it's all happened very quickly. It's been an amazing couple of years, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been great. I was happy to train 10 winners last year, and sort of set out to try and train 20 this year and to get 33 for the season, and add a stakes winner to that and 7 or 8 city winners. It was great.
What's the secret? I mean, Reece has done a great job as well, and I'm going to ask you how difficult it would have been if the Inglis Online auctions hadn't existed, how tricky it would be, and you've cornered that market, and you're kind of turning other people's, this is a bit harsh way of saying it, but other people's trash into your treasure in a way, like sort of horses who aren't perfect or for whatever reason been discarded by other stables, but you seem to have found the secret to getting them going. What's the... Paperboy, Sir Callahad, I think No Effort might have been another one as well. What's the secret to fixing up horses that obviously need a bit of fixing up?
All those three horses that we just sort of named them, they haven't really got any issues. They were well maintained before they arrived with me, and I suppose just a change of scenery. A lot of the horses we get have come from a metropolitan environment or a trainer that's got sort of upwards of 100 horses, and they might just you know, be the run-of-the-mill horse sort of there, and they come to our stable and they're one of our better ones, and, you know, we try and treat all our horses exactly the same, and I suppose just trying to be really hands-on, get them out in the Sandhills track at Cranbourne. It's a change of scenery for them. They're not going around in circles following a white running rail every morning.
How important is that hill track at Cranbourne?
Oh, not so much the hill track, just the whole change of scenery out there for them, you know, the twists and the turns and around the dam and the heavy sand, and it's just a totally different outlook. They go from being in a stabled environment 24/7 to coming and living at our place where they're outside for about 10 hours of a day before coming into a box of an evening, and then those older horses, we try and make the majority of their work done out there, and it's just a different environment and a change of routine for them.
Those English online sales, there's a degree of disclosure, but you still have to be shrewd and do your homework, and you know that you might be taking on something with one of these horses. When you get them home, do you give them a complete physical, basically?
Pretty much. I've got a great vet, Dave Shepherd. I've got a great farrier, Colin Eden, and normally when a new one gets there, I'll have a ride on them the first morning. Then I'll get both farrier and vet to stand back and have a look at them trot, go right over them. Got a great chiropractor, Christian Langeter. Brendan McCarthy does a bit of work for us as well, and just go right over the whole horse, find something that we might be able to improve. You know, if we can find an underlying issue, treat it straight away, and I suppose just try and get them pain-free, and, you know, normally that's when you see their form turn around.
Is it only possible to do that after you've bought them? How much can you do before you purchase them?
We do as much as we can. Normally, you know, we go right through the horse's form, watch a lot of replays. They might have a habit or a piece of gear they're wearing to try and correct that, and then find out why it's doing that, and then you know, you might try and find a stable hand or a track work rider or a jockey that's ridden a horse previously, and just
there's a bit of Sherlock Holmes involved, isn't there?
There is a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, so they have them regularly, these auctions, don't they?
They do. I was probably, when I very first started, it was before the online auctions, and you used to have to go out to Inglis and you could inspect them and have a look at them. But I suppose now it's a little bit different where they all go online, and there's probably a lot of horses that, in my opinion, probably should just be retired or rehomed or something like that. It's sort of people trying to move them on as a last resort, and I don't think that's the right thing to do. Like, but look,
they sort of want it to be someone else's problem.
Pretty much. Like, you know, Sir Callahady was one of the first ones we bought. I retired him last week. He's been a great success story for us. We paid $22,000 for him. He won $280,000 in his time with us. He was my first Metro winner, and he's my favourite. And he just had been running below par this campaign, so we decided to retire him. And
he's gone? Oh, he's retired?
Yeah, retired him after his run at Sandown last Wednesday. I just didn't like when the acid went on. His sort of head come up, and he didn't look all that fair income about it. So I don't care if he hangs around the stables for as long as need be. He'll get a good home, and, you know, that's something that I really want to, you know, make an emphasis on as well. You know, they've got to try and have a career post-racing and do their best thing for the horse.
What do you do? Obviously, afterlife is a big issue with horses and rehoming and retraining. What sort of ideas would you have for a horse like Sir Callahad in retirement?
I'm not really sure. He's a horse that we've never jumped or anything like that, so I don't know if he's a lovely sound horse. He's never had a cortisone injection. He's a lovely natured horse, so it'll just be a matter of once the weather starts to pick up, he can go and have a break for a couple of months in a paddock, and then, whatever it costs to get him retrained, I'm happy to spend and just give him his best chance at a life after racing.
Did these online auctions basically become what they are because of COVID, or was it happening anyway?
No, it was happening anyway. I think it's been a lot more publicised, and it's been quite successful over the last couple of years for people, and it's you know, it's bumped the prices up of it, and it's become a lot stronger market than what it was.
That was always going to happen, wasn't it?
It was, but you know, if you're having success at it, you know, hopefully there's the people behind you that want to back you to keep going out and buying these horses.
I remember talking to you and Reece Goodwin about how important they've been, and Reece basically said if it wasn't for them, I don't know how I'd get started because I can't afford to go into the yearling marketplace and so on. Take us through the world of the online auction. So They come around every couple of weeks. There's an amount of due diligence that you do. How many do you screen? What's the screening process? Who helps you out? How do you narrow it down to a wish list?
I've bought a few slow ones along the way and made a few bad purchases. It's not 100% success rate or anything like that, but I suppose I've got better at it. As I said, I spend 2 or 3 days going right through the form of all these horses, and then I suppose you'll make a short list and then you'll go back and watch a lot of replays. I might bounce someone like Dean Lester a text message and ask him for his opinion, and he'll either tell me that I'm kidding myself or I'm on the right path, and go from there, I suppose.
Well, Stradari was obviously one of the Dean Lester horses a couple of weeks ago. Sadly, it didn't win at Maui. I think the money was on at Maui, and then it came out at won its next start. And Stradari, Dean and Sandra, his mum, have had a long history with that family. It must be a nice kick along when a great ally like Dino, when you can deliver with a horse like Stradari.
Yeah, I got a really big buzz out of that. I grew up being apprenticed to Robbie Griffiths and always been around Cranbourne, and obviously Dean and Robbie were very close when I started out there, and you know, you hear him on the radio every morning, and Sandra was always a trainer down at Cranbourne that you'd see first thing of a morning, and I suppose a bit chuffed to be given a chance to try and get that horse going, I suppose, and then to get a result out of him, I got a really big kick out of that.
Has Dino ever told you about a horse called Fluffy?
No.
We had a horse called Fluffy. Its nickname was Fluffy because the Scottish was trained by about 40 different trainers before Dean and Sandra got Fluffy. And the Scottish girl, he was such an unattractive, hairy thing. A Kinnear clip him because he's too fluffy. So he became... Clem Dimsey actually called him Fluffy when he won a race at the Seymour Picnics. And we won first up with him... Druin, I think it was, and it was the biggest thrill of all time because there's no way Fluffy could ever win a race, and Dean and Sandra are eternally grateful. And you know where we went that night? Not the tie in Cranbourne, across the road, we went to the Chinese celebrate. Hey, I just want to play you a horse I want to ask you about before we take a break. I think this is one of the greatest success stories because of the quick turnaround with this horse, and it's Paperboy.
And to show some decorum, and Paperboy is launching the grey now. Below the 200, Paperboy takes the lead from Bee Hunter. Old Flame is late. Paperboy inside the 100, clear from Old Flame, who's finishing well. But Paperboy is holding on. Paperboy won the last. A long neck, Old Flame, Bee Hunter, then show some decorum.
To me, this is the most high-profile turnaround that you've been able to do, Paperboy.
Yeah, I got a really big kick out of that. John Price, his former trainer, I remember coming past one morning and we'd yak most mornings, and he asked me what I thought the horse was worth. Obviously, I buy a lot of horses online, and I sort of said, $40,000 to $50,000, I thought, and he sort of had him marked as about a $40,000 purchase, and then I said, well, the fairest thing to do for your owners is to put him online and, he'll go for what the market prices him at, I suppose, and he said, yep, good idea. And then it was pretty well known that that horse was going to go online around Cranbourne, and a few people mentioned it to me. If I was going to buy him, they'd seen me speak to John or something, and hadn't really put much thought into it, and went home and went right back through his form and watched a lot of his replays and spoke to Spatch White, another good mate of mine that works down at the track. And
spies everywhere, haven't you?
Yeah, and spoke to Dean Lester, and I sort of thought I'd try and get ahead of the jump and approach John before he went on to the online auction the following day and put a price to him, and he spoke to the owners and got it over the line. And I'm thankful for my main client, Anthony Jacobs. He jumped on board, and we were able to purchase the horse, and went around. John was actually really good. I went and had a ride on the horse the morning prior and got my vet to have a look at him, and providing we came up with the money before the auction started on the Friday morning, the horse was ours, so everything was ticked, and away we went.
And that was one win, Caulfield. What's been the $40,000 outlay into how much earnings now?
Yeah, 50 we paid for him, and I think he's won about 160, and he's had 2 wins and 2 placings all in Saturday Metro grade, and you could probably make a case for him being 4 for 4. He was out beaten in a photo in one of those second placings and another run. He sort of got cluttered up and he was going nowhere, and it wasn't until he got clean air late that he really savaged the line, and he ran a really good second to I can't remember the horse. Don't Tell the Boss at Flemington.
Yeah, no, he's been amazing, as so many of them have. Just before we take a break, they don't all work out. The most high-profile one was Surprise Baby, and he'd had a sort of a funny career with Paul Prusker where he hardly raced him, but he was just such an unbelievable talent. And then he ended up with you, which was a great endorsement for you at the time, that's such a high-profile horse, but he had the engine still, but he just and there was one or two runs where he showed a glimpse of what he could do, but it was sort of that end of his career where you couldn't quite resuscitate him.
Yeah, if I could have my time again, he ran really well first up. I thought he ran okay in an Australian Cup, and then he went to Sydney and he raced on that really heavy track that day, and it really knocked the stuffing out of him, and it really pancaked him, and obviously he was starting to get a little bit long in the tooth, and me and John had a discussion, and John didn't want the horse to be seen as, you know, one of those 8 or 9 year olds that's just going to keep spinning around, and it reached the pinnacle and the heights that he had, and the decision was made to retire him, find a good home for him.
But even though he didn't show it on the racetrack, I know you were saying, like, you could still feel how good a horse he was underneath you when you rode him.
Yeah, he had a massive engine. You did your evens and that sort of thing by himself, and, you know, he'd just sort of go through the motions. But when you worked him with something else, I know we galloped him with no effort once or twice, and he'd make her look like a picnic horse. He'd sit her up 5 or 6 lengths and go past her like she was tied to the fence. And, she's not a bad
yardstick.
So, he definitely he was a great horse.
Speaking of picnic horses, we're going to go back through your story, and it'll touch on your history at the picnics as well. I'm with Gavin Bedgood. He's Mr. 22% from his last 50 runners, 26 minutes to 10. We're going to go back right to the start of the story. It might even be like a pony club in the Cranbourne area. That's where we'll probably start the story after this break.
The news and stories from racing's heartland. This is RSN's Racing Pulse.
22 minutes to 10, I'm with Gavin Bedgood, who is absolutely flying at the moment, but he wasn't always. It all has to start somewhere. And, Bedgie, you've been a Cranbourne native from day one, haven't you? And I think your first introduction to horses was the usual story of Pony Club, wasn't it?
Yeah, I went to Pony Club at Lang Warren, just 10 minutes down the road, and got started there. And then Mum and Dad said, if you want horses, that you've got to help pay for them. So I got a weekend job working at Robbie Griffiths's and doing school holidays and weekends there. And that turned into me wanting to leave school and be a jockey, and went and started an apprenticeship there. And I got pretty heavy pretty quick. But
I saw in your profile, because this goes back to that you're such an over-orderer when we go to the tyre, you it's on your own stable profile, because the thing that stitched it up was your love of food.
Yeah, so... yeah, stayed on there for a couple of years, and went to Caulfield and worked for Colin Little for 12 months, and rode work at Mornington for probably 12 months, and been at Cranbourne ever since, really.
The Langley Pony Club, like, it's such an epicentre for, horse racing families. Were there a lot of racing kids down there? Is that kind of how you showed a little bit of an interest? Because there would have been sons and daughters of a lot of racing people at the Langley Pony Club, wouldn't there?
No, there wasn't, actually. No, I can't think of anybody that was racing. And
No racing in your family?
No. My great uncle was a horse trainer, Bernie Love, at Epsom back in the day. But other than that, no racing.
You've got the most misspelled surname in racing, the double G. What's the origin of Bedgood?
I've got no idea.
Like somewhere in Europe or something? Or
I'd only be guessing.
Have you ever seen a double G, Mikey?
Not in that sense, Matty.
There you go. You're an unusual man, Gavin. So you started working school holidays for Robbie Griffiths, and then we'll talk about the Robbie Lang era as well. What was it like, Cranbourne back then? Because it's just become a city now. Like, back in those days, was that still when they were working on the other track, the racetrack, or not?
No, I was always at the training complex. I've been down there since 2000, I think, and I think, it was pretty well established by the time I got there.
So what did you learn from your teachers along the way? So how long were you at Robbie Griffiths?
Yeah, I was there a couple of years. Then, as I said, Colin Littles for 12 months, and then I rode track work for Chris Hyland for probably 3 years and worked full-time there for a while.
That would have been interesting, because you're both volatile.
Yeah, he could give a good spray then. He's mellowed quite a lot since then, but I suppose he was the... Working for him, I suppose, ignited my passion for jumps racing.
Was that when he had that great jumper who didn't really jump that well? He used to crash through but win anyway?
No, Toulouse Lautrec. He was a couple of years after that, but he had a horse called Liquid Lunch that won a Grand National Steeple, and another horse I remember really well, Muckle Tao. He ran second to Frankie Very Much in the Grand Annual, and it was a dashing display that day. He led by a margin, and I think he was only run down after the last fence, and I remember watching that race, and Chris used to let me school him a bit track work, and that sort of is how I got started.
Is that for those of us, I remember seeing the vision of Hugh Bowman down at Warrnambool this year, where he and Jamie Carr schooled some horses with Steve Pateman, and then one of them, the horse sort of took off before Hugh Bowman. So is the first few times you do it, and then in a race and running the Grand Annual course and things like that, is it just in a... What's the adrenaline rush of riding over the jumps compared to over the flat? Is it just an extra kick?
Yeah, nothing compares. It's totally different, especially riding at those carnivals like Warrnambool and Oakbank. You know, even canter into the barriers and you've got all the crowd. It's just a great atmosphere and, big rush.
You had a massive, successful 12-year career over the jumps, but before that was the picnics. So take us through the transition from just riding track for a few trainers to actually getting your picnic licence.
Yeah, I just rode a lot of track work and thought, you know, there was a lot of picnic trainers and jockeys at Cranbourne, so I thought I'd have a go. And I rode for a season and a half, and I think I rode 33 winners and finished runner-up on the premiership both years.
That's pretty good for a season and a half. Did you just hit the ground running, did you?
Yeah, pretty much. I had good support early doors. I used to get on a lot of horses that were sort of right up in the handicap for my claim at the start. And
Was this the Gavin Brady era?
No, long after that. Kane Harris, Adam Bodie.
Oh, sorry, Adam Bodie is what I meant.
Yeah, Adam, Ray Douglas, all them. They're leading three riders, I suppose.
It's a pretty interesting characters there, including Razor and a few others. What was it like? Like jockey's room at the picnics, going around all these bush tracks. Sometimes Saturday, Sunday. I can't believe they go Balnarring Saturday, Swiss Creek Sunday on the same weekend. What was that? Because I love it. But what, for the listeners who don't believe it when I tell them, from a jockey's point of view, what was it like riding the picnic circuit for a season and a half?
Oh, it's so competitive. It's great grassroots racing, and I still love going to the picnics. I'd rather go to Balnarring on a Saturday than Flemington. You can pack your esky, and you know, the form's not that hard to read. There's normally one or two standouts on the card, and it's really enjoyable.
And I know, obviously, as a jockey you wouldn't, but as a trainer you don't mind having a bet when the moment's right. And the betting opportunity for stables that you would have ridden for at the picnics, like some of them you get 10 or 15 bookies, don't you?
Yeah, it's massive. Like you get a full betting ring, you go to the professionals now and you might see one or two there, but it's a real eye-opener for people, I think.
We were lucky enough, you know the horse, he's known as the GOAT down at Cranbourne, grace of all time, mind you, and Maldestro, and he won a Mansfield Cup, and that was the most amazing day I've ever had, because the idea with the crowd and winning a Towns Cup, and you would have won a few of those, and the crowd reception, these are the fastest of the slow, these horses, aren't they? But they kind of got a bit of a hero status, haven't they, amongst that environment?
Oh, it's great. I remember when I very first started, Robbie Lang gifted me a horse. I think he'd had about 16 starts, and he'd won a maiden at Cranbourne, but he was well out of form, and I didn't have my trainer's license then, so a trainer at Cranbourne, Gary Mallinson, he was sort of semi-retired and just used to stuff around with one or two horses, and he took the horse into his name and I suppose let me part train it with him, and we took him to the picnics, and he won four on the trot, and he won a Hillsville Cup, and that led us to getting our second horse, which was a horse called My Dancing Jewel, and he'd come from Singapore and hadn't won a race for about 3 years, and we took him to the picnics to try and get his confidence up, and he won three on the trot, and he won a Mansfield and an Alexandra Cup, and they really get a cult following, those good horses around the picnics, and it's a really big buzz.
You're a star jockey over the jumps, and one of the great eras was Mazzucano. What was the other one, the Houlihan one? That was
Pentific
Mazzucano, and there was I've never known a greater build-up to a match race than the Australian steeplechase at Sandown when Mazzucano was the original champion who'd get back and swoop home, and then Pentific came along, and they were both megastars. And you won that grand annual on Bannerstrand, Vondusa, Briley, Australian steeple on Vindicating. But what was it like? Because Mazzucano is one of the most electric jumpers I've ever seen. What was it like riding? Remind us why Mazzucano was such a champion.
He was just a very, very good wet tracker. I remember that year at Sandown, it was like, oh, they probably wouldn't even race on it now. You'd walk it and you'd have mud nearly to your knees going up the hill, and he used to just plough through it like he was on good ground. And
he'd just sit back though, wouldn't he? And then all of a sudden,
I remember every time I rode him, Robbie would leg me on and say, you know, try and have him up in the first four or five, and he did not go early. I don't know why. And you'd be, you know, one of the rules riding at Sandown, you try not to use your horse going up the hill. You want to try and get a nice conservative resting run, and you'd be heeling him along and going nowhere, and you'd get to the top of the hill and then other horses would be coming off the bridle, and he used to just kick into overdrive, change up a gear, and off he went, and he'd go past them like they were tied to the fence, jumping the third last. And
he did it a number of times, and Sandown was his track, wasn't it?
Yeah, he won a midweeker there by about 12 lengths, and that led him to the Australian, and he won that by 20 lengths, I think, and then he won the Crispy's following start, and he actually, I think he won by about 6 that day, but he broke down, and I had to get off and lead him back to the scale. He was that sore, and he had 2 years off the scene, and
that's when Pentific arrived on the scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, he went through the Oakbank early in the season, and I think he might have won the Hiskins at the end of that year, and then they met up the following year. Mazzucano won the Australian, and then they met up in the Crisp, and Pentific gave him a towel up that day. And
was that disappointing, knowing that he got you when you were 2 years past your best?
Yeah, I think he was. I don't think he was 100% going into that race that day, and it would have been great for him to meet, you know, on level terms. But Pentific, he was a very dashing horse, and he probably had a couple of years on Mazzucano too. He probably, as you said, met him at the end of his time rather than at the beginning.
Oakbank and Warrnambool, you rode massive winners over both carnivals. Can you, and I'll ask you about Oakbank too, obviously, but what the vibe of winning in front of a big crowd at Oakbank compared to the vibe of winning in front of a Thursday crowd at Warrnambool, is it the same feeling?
I suppose Warrnambool, you know a lot of the people there. A lot of people, even from down Cranbourne way, they'll make the trek to Warrnambool, and it's a massive racing crowd where you go to Oakbank, and you probably didn't. It was more like a bit of a festival, I suppose. It wasn't a diehards racing crowd where Warrnambool probably was.
You're filthy about the Oakbank situation.
Oh, for sure. Like, it had a lot of history, and I used to really love going to the carnival and riding, and it's a shame to see jumping go in that state.
Speaking of filthy, this is I'll tell you why it was filthy. This is one of the greatest, lauded as one of the greatest training performances of all time. This is Sir Pentire winning the Grand Annual at Warrnambool.
In the straight now, the jumping's all over. They run on raw energy now. Elgar Hood out in a mob of horses who are riderless, and Sir Pentire over on the inside. Could it be the greatest training performance in the history of the race? I think it is. Sir Pentire races to the lead. Hasn't raced for 2 years, but Sir Pentire first up won the Grand Annual. What a training performance from Robbie Lang. Second,
coulda, shoulda, woulda been Gavin Bedgood, but there was something went on that prevented that from being, with that epic first up win in the Grand Annual from Robbie Lang down there. We're going to tell you why after this short break. Now, you worked for Robbie Lang at that time, and Robbie was an outside the square man. There's no doubt about that. And that was the 2009 Grand Annual we played just before the break. The winner was Sir Pentire, and you probably were due to what happened? Bill Williamson ended up in the saddle.
Yeah, I'd ridden that horse the majority of his mornings for about 6 months, I reckon.
And that was a rehab project, wasn't it, Sir Pentire?
Yeah, yep. He hadn't raced over jumps for 3 years, and I don't think he'd had a... He might not have even had a race for 3 years. It had been a long time, and he'd been in and out, and his flat trials were bloody ordinary. And I remember Robbie questioning himself a few times if he was doing the right thing, and even when he started going to the jumps trials, he wasn't trialling anything like... what he had been early in his career. And he was a good flat galloper in his day. He won a St. Ledger as a three-year-old, and he was sort of questioning himself. And as the horse got fitter, he started trialling better, and he was trialling twice on the one day. Might have trialled over hurdles at 9 o'clock in the morning and then trialled over fences at lunchtime. And
did that give you later in life a string to your bow as well to learn what the range of possibilities was with a horse?
Yeah, there's no rules to training a horse. And yeah, I suppose I learnt lots of things with my 10 years at Robbie's. And you might have a horse and you look back and remember something that he did with a horse that worked, and try that out for yourself.
So getting back to that grand annual, so I think he'd done multiple tendons. You know, he had 30 jump schools or something in 2 years. I don't know what it was, but so it was going to be the great first up quest down at Warrnambool, but then you fell by the wayside, didn't you?
Yeah, I trialled him over hurdles and fences, and then I trialled another one of Robbie's that fell at the last, a horse called Daneland. I still remember it. Scott Brunton owned it and sent it over and crashed at the last, and I broke my collarbone, and that was the end of my season very early on in the piece. And I remember going down to Warrnambool with Robbie to watch the hurdle schools, and he couldn't get anybody to ride the horse. I think he asked everybody there, and Nathan Dunn trialled him for him, but he already had a ride, and he didn't have a rider booked for the horse right up until race morning. And I remember riding him the day prior at the beach with my arm in a sling at Port Ferry, and he felt $1 million. And, it was a real kick in the guts to have to sit there and watch that race. And I remember getting straight in the car straight afterwards and driving back to Cranbourne.
But I guess you sort of cheered home the feat itself for Robbie and Bill.
Yeah, no,
or were you just in the car on the way home?
It was a strange feeling that day, because that was the day that Rob Hulls put a, you know, jumps racing on notice, and it had been given a lifeline, a time frame, I suppose, and they were going to can it. So I remember sitting in a pub in Berwick with all the jumping boys a couple of days later, wondering what we were going to do, but it's great to see the resurgence of it.
Just looking back on that, and on I got fed up with jumps racing at that stage, because every time I went to the...
Yeah, we all hated you there for a minute.
Yeah, no, I can't believe you even turned up today. But I got sick of seeing horses crash and die. Something had to give. Something had to change. If it was to continue, it couldn't continue as it was. And then Robbie Lang was a major factor here, because he identified an issue with the jumps, didn't he? Like almost a trip bar. So tell us about that era. When you look back, was it... by hell or high water, you were all going to just keep supporting it regardless of how many fatalities there were?
Oh, I suppose looking back at it now, something did have to change.
So am I off the hook?
No, they just went for the easy fix to just get rid of it instead of trying to change and modify things. And I'm glad that it did get a reprieve. And you only have to look at the safety aspect of it now. It's gone ahead in leaps and bounds, and the metal A-frame that they had at the back of the hurdles was... the jumps were probably too small. They were on too much of a lean.
Were they running too fast?
Were probably going too fast, and they were running on firm ground. And when horses were tired, instead of having to shorten up and really think about where they left the ground from when they were getting fatigued, they'd just take off from anywhere, leave a leg behind, and or put a leg down thinking they were just going to brush through the top of it, and quite often got that A-frame, and that would bring their undoing.
There's still a lot of friendships I had back then that haven't been patched up, I've got to point out.
You owned a jumper too, didn't you?
Yeah, but he didn't fall over. In the ad break, we were talking about the Darwin Cup and how amazing it would be to get up there or even have a horse, and you said you'd love to, but... at the moment, it's such an important period of time for you to be on the tools, because you're going to get wiped off the floor a bit when all the superstars come back, and your horses will probably just fade out of view a little bit. So it's important. This is still a very important time of year for a trainer like you.
Yeah, this winter's been like our spring carnival, I suppose. I'm realistic about the level of ability my horses have got, and the need to stay relevant in this sport, I guess. So... need to churn over the winners while we can. Like, it's been a massive season that we've had, and you can't rest on your laurels in this game, and you get forgotten about pretty quickly. So I know that come the end of September, October, November, my runners in town are going to be slim to none, and I need to capitalise on that over the next 4 to 5 week period, I suppose.
And I guess over the next 2 or 3 years, you need to make that transition from sort of patch up online, those sort of horses, to, you know, being one of those players who can facilitate those nice yearlings or a nice import, things like that. Is that the next stage of your career to put yourself into that game?
Yeah, for sure. The reason we had to go down that tried horse avenue was when you're starting out, you need to have runners, so you need to be getting your name out there and trying to get a score on the board. And we didn't have anybody to back us into buying a yearling, and we didn't have 2 years to wait around to see if it was going to deliver. But we had a winner at sale a few weeks ago, a horse called Rose Dior. She was the first yearling we purchased that year. And then we had another one win at Pakenham last Friday. Co-actually, he was the only yearling we bought the second year. So it was great to see them win. We've been able to purchase 7 this year. Hopefully there's something, you know, amongst them that can, you know, take shirk that label, I suppose, of just being labelled as a tried horse trainer, because it's not the case. It's just the card we've been dealt, I suppose, and you just got to make the best of what you've got.
I remember, I think it was Robbie who bemoaned me one day. He said, people keep describing me as a jumps trainer. He said, I do that, but I've also, you know, I also wouldn't mind a Redoute's Choice either to walk through. So.
Oh, for sure. You know, in the time I was with Robbie, he won South Australian Derbies, Adelaide Cups, Australian Cups, and always had a good two-year-old. Every year he'd win a two-year-old race before Christmas, and you know, he was a great trainer of any horse that was delivered to him.
Whether it's too much pressure or not, you've now got the label of punter's pal. So anything coming up in the next, you seem to be knocking out at least a winner a week. So which one is it this week?
Hopefully Stradari can keep the ball rolling. I thought he won a moderate race at Bairnsdale last week, but he won really well. And I think he's in a nice race tomorrow at Cranbourne. And we've got another horse going to Flemington on Saturday, a horse called Real Easer. He's a little bit out of form, but couldn't have galloped any better this morning, and gets the blinkers on for the first time. And he might have a form reversal off a freshen up.
Oh, whoa, okay. Form reversal, blinkers. Hey, some really good text messages, very encouraging. They love you. But there's this one also. Does Gav remember a Lang horse called Direct Charge? Won the Maribyrnong Plate and then went amiss. This is from a no-namer. Do you remember Direct Charge?
I do. Me and my partner Karen, we actually took the horse to Sydney for Robbie, and he ran up there in one of the English Race Series races. He looked like a two-year-old as a yearling, that horse. I remember riding him early doors, and he was just a very well-developed and was always going to go early, and just he was the perfect two-year-old.
How's this one? This has got 10 exclamation marks at the end of it. Hey, Matty, awesome to hear how Gavin talks of looking after his retired horses and how he cares about their life after racing. What a ripper guy. You rock, Gavin. 10 exclamation marks. There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you to whoever that was. Matty, love what Benji's doing. Can you ask him how we get involved in his stable and if he has any available horses, please. Cheers, Brett. And that's probably not a bad note to round off the chat on, is how do people tap into this success story, Benji?
Yeah, we're pretty active on the tried horse market. We've got a couple of yearlings there at the moment that still have a little bit of availability in them. We can get on our website, gavinbedgegoodracing.com.au. There are horses available there, and we always put up whatever we've purchased on the online auctions on Facebook and through our web page, but they do get taken up pretty quickly the last few months. You know, 24, 48 hours, they've been gone.
And what a good sign that is. Hey, now, look, if your car's been towed away, which I fear it may have because I don't know where you park, but there is an impound lot in Carlton that costs you about $600 to get it out, but I've had to do that before myself, so I can at least point you in the right direction. And that bottle of booze I promised you from our gift cabinet, it's gone.
Of course it is.
Hey, mate, thanks for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you in, and best of luck with, Flemington Saturday and Stradari next time it goes around as well. The stable's on fire, and you're a credit to the industry, mate. Well done.
Thanks very much, Matty.
Gavin Bedgegood.